This week saw the first ever ICBM fired in anger. The International Criminal Court has put out an arrest warrant for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and world leaders gathered for the G20 summit. We'll look at all this and more on today's Trumpet World. So much of this week's news has revolved around escalating threats and violence in Ukraine and with the war going on with Russia there. Critical cables have been cut in the North Sea. We've seen the first phone call by a Western leader to Vladimir Putin in a long, long time. Ukraine was given the go-ahead to fire long-range missiles into Russia. And then towards the end of the week, we had an ICBM strike on Ukraine. So to get us caught up with all of that, first we'll turn to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Palmer. We did cross a grim milestone this week, just crossing over the 1,000-day mark of Russia's full-scale war against Ukraine. So it has dragged on for far longer than most onlookers expected, and there are now well over a million casualties when you add up the dead and wounded from both sides. But the war, of course, is still raging on, and as you said, there have been some major developments this week. The first one I'd like to talk about is what you mentioned there, that the US and UK gave Ukraine permission this week to use certain Western missiles to strike military targets inside of Russian territory. So before this, Ukraine was only able to use these Western missiles to hit Russian targets that were inside of their borders, inside of Ukraine. But Ukrainian leaders had been asking for years, really, to be allowed to hit beyond the border, because without that permission, the Russians had a major advantage. The Russians were free to basically use fighter jets and bombers to attack anywhere, anytime they wanted. And then all they had to do was land those warplanes back across the border inside of Russia, and they would be safe to refuel them and rearm them for the next mission. And in the case of missile systems, the Russians could just leave those stations safely on the Russian side of the border and fire all day long at Ukrainian targets, basically with impunity, because Ukraine was not allowed to take the missile systems out. So this constraint was, it was handcuffing Ukraine in some notable ways, but this week those handcuffs came off. The United States green-lighted Ukraine firing ATACMS missiles across the border at targets inside of Russia, and then the UK agreed to let Ukraine use different versions of the Storm Shadow missile, also at targets inside of Russia. And now France is apparently close to possibly greenlighting this as well with some of their longer range missiles. So that was a major development for Ukraine to be given that permission, and they wasted no time taking advantage of it. On Tuesday, Ukraine fired some ATACMS missiles at an ammunition supply location in Russia's Bryansk region. And then the next day, they fired some Storm Shadows at a different military facility, also in Bryansk. So Ukraine is taking full advantage of that permission, striking some very important military targets. And the Russians, as you would expect, are fuming about this. Vladimir Putin started rattling his nuclear saber again in response. This was on Tuesday that he signed a law finalizing a revision to Russia's nuclear doctrine. The new doctrine basically says from now on, if any country attacks Russia, even if it's just with conventional weapons, as long as that country is backed by another country that has nuclear weapons, or if the attacks are considered to threaten, you know, the integrity of the Russian state, any of that would be enough for Putin to strike back with nuclear weapons. So it is important that the published doctrine from a country like Russia and from a man like Vladimir Putin, it actually means very little. You know, the truth is this is a mafia state run by thugs and one chief thug at the top. It's very clear that Putin will do whatever he wants, whenever he wants, with his nuclear weapons without publishing his plans for the world to see. And we have, of course, also heard Russia threaten nuclear Armageddon numerous times since it started this war, dozens of times, actually. Pretty much anytime things are not going well for the Russians, which they are not right now in light of this new latitude that Ukraine has been given. So this is almost certainly just bluster and saber rattling, just an attempt to scare nations away from standing up to Russia's aggression. But that being said, when you're talking about these unthinkably powerful nuclear weapons, almost certainly is not enough to be comforting. The stakes are just so high that these kinds of threats cannot be totally ignored. And then there is also one very big difference this time as compared to other times that Putin has threatened nuclear war. This came on Thursday when Putin launched what very well may have been an intercontinental ballistic missile at a civilian target in the city of Dnipro, Ukraine. Now, this was not armed with a nuclear warhead, but it is a missile that's designed to carry a nuclear payload, and its range is remarkable. This missile, if it was the ICBM that it looks to have been, can exceed 3,400 miles. So that's far beyond what Russia would have needed for this kind of strike. And this would actually, as you said at the start there, this would actually mark the first time ever that a nuclear-capable intercontinental ballistic missile has been fired at another country during war. So a dramatic escalation there. And it looks like Putin's decision to use this was meant to be just a chilling reminder that Russia has nuclear weapons, an extremely powerful arsenal of nuclear weapons that it could, you know, use whenever it chooses to. So here we are, 1,000 days into the war, and there is a new U.S. president about to come in, which could shake things up. But actually, there are also reports that Donald Trump was consulted on the Biden administration's plan to give Ukraine this permission. And the reports say that Trump gave it the thumbs up. So that's still unconfirmed. And it's hard to know for sure what will happen in the weeks and months ahead. But I think that everyone agrees that 1,000 days is a tragically long time for this war to have gone on, and that 1 million plus casualties is an utterly tragic number.
Yeah, I think this is one of the most significant events, I think, of the war so far, this firing of the ICBM. That has got to have gotten a whole lot of people all across Europe and NATO. I would have loved to know what was going on inside various different NATO command stations last night. I mean, this is a weapon that, yeah, an ICBM, it's nuclear capable. Its sole purpose is to carry nuclear weapons. I think by treaty, Vladimir Putin probably had to inform the United States that he was firing this weapon before he did so. Whether he stuck to the treaty or not, of course, I don't think we know, but I believe he would have had to have, if it was an ICBM, he would have had to have done that.
I have heard some speculation that perhaps it was not an ICBM, but instead an IRBM, an intermediate range ballistic missile. It's still not totally confirmed that it was an ICBM, but we'll see as the dust settles here.
Yeah, from what I've seen, it seems like it was most likely an RS-26, which Russia classifies an ICBM, but I think they only classify it as an ICBM to get around Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, the INF Treaty, because by the INF Treaty, they're not allowed to develop intermediate range missiles. These are actually considered more scary than ICBMs because they reach their targets, even though they're shorter range, they reach their targets more quickly, which means you have less time to respond and less time to decide, okay, do I need to return fire with my nuclear missiles? These were outlawed. It seems like Russia got around that by doing a missile test without any payload so that it met the minimum threshold to be an ICBM. But actually, that may be a misclassification, and it may well be an IRBM. That was kind of the latest I got, at least from looking up some various arms control wonks and their take on it. But I think either way, whether it's an ICBM, an IRBM, it was a nuclear-capable missile that was taking off, that would have then set off alarm bells all across NATO, and that no one would know for sure whether it contained a nuclear missile or not until it landed. And they're more expensive than standard missiles. And just by convention, you don't use these for standard missiles because everyone freaks out because there could be a nuclear missile inside. So I imagine there would have been some freaking out going involved. Again, I think probably Putin told people ahead of time it wasn't a nuclear missile. But do you trust the Russians' word? I think there would have been a big sigh of relief when it landed and it wasn't nuclear. So I think this has got ramifications, really long-range ramifications. Like, this would have given Europe a real fright. And I think we'll see a step up in this event that we've been tracking of fear of Russia really transforming Europe. I mean, we're kind of weaving together a few different stories here. That was one of the new stories that we had on our website this week, where Joshua Michels put together just a compilation of various different arms companies are doing to prepare for war, based on an article from the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, where it was on an outline of a 1,000-page secret strategy paper called Operation Plan Germany that was basically just all kinds of different exercises to get civilian governments used to working with the military and dealing with scenarios. So that's something I think that would have put a lot of fear into Europe. You also were tracking this cutting of these various Baltic cables that I think is related to the escalation and that would have also put a lot of fear into Europe.
Yes, I think this very well could be related. So this was a Chinese flagged cargo ship called the Yiping 3, and it had just left the Russian port of Ust-Luga there on the Baltic. And this vessel was actually captained by a Russian national, from what I understand. And it apparently dropped anchor over the Sea Lion 1 cable, which connects Finland and Germany. And it severed that very important cable. And then it also managed to cut another cable connecting Sweden and Lithuania. So very serious damage to these undersea cables that are vital for all kinds of telecommunication systems. And the fact that this Chinese flagship, captained by a Russian, hit two of these within just a day or so, this really rules out the possibility of an accident. And then when you consider the fact that just a year ago, a different Chinese ship, the Nunu Polar Bear, severed a pipeline in this same general area of the Baltic Sea, I think the pattern here becomes just undeniable. This is sabotage by the Russia-China axis, and it's very disturbing. It looks like this very well could have been part of Putin's response to the United States allowing Ukraine to hit those targets inside Russia. It may have been a message to Germany and to other European nations saying, you better watch out. You better not follow the US's lead here, because Russia has plenty of ways to make you suffer. And then the Danish Navy, as I understand it, they actually detained this Chinese ship. And so investigations are underway right now. So we'll have to see what comes of this and whether Europe will just say that they're deeply concerned, as the case often has been with these kinds of things, or whether more actual action might be taken against these adversarial nations that are just hell-bent on conquest and destruction.
I mean, I imagine what we'll see is kind of a bit of both, where we've had this trend over the last couple of years since Russia's invasion of Ukraine, where Europe has not done very much to confront Russia realistically, but at the same time has done an awful lot to prepare to defend themselves. And we've had several countries reintroduce conscription. We've had, was it Finland and Sweden join NATO? We've had Polish defense spending explode, German defense spending take a massive step up. Poland's in the process of fortifying their border. Like, there's a lot of very real concrete military preparations going on right now in Europe. And I think this week is going to be big for that, because we, like you say, this is a warning from Vladimir Putin. I think both things, like the firing of the ICBM, was completely militarily unnecessary. That, I mean, it's almost using a handgun to swat a fly, or a bullet, like shooting a bullet at a fly to kill it. There are much more efficient ways of doing that. Either he's completely out of ordinary missiles and is thoroughly desperate, or he's sending a message. And I think it's very clearly the second. And then the sinking of the ship, like we've got the dramatic world ending, we're threatening with nuclear bombs and we're firing an ICBM type of a warning. And then the much more practical, thinkable, cutting off your internet, messing with your economies, causing you a lot of damage, causing politicians a lot of unpopularity if prices are going up and that kind of thing. And saying, look, Europe, we have a whole range of options that we can use. You push us too far and it's the apocalypse. But even if it's not that far, we can really hurt you in a lot of other ways. And so I think that range of different warnings this week will have a big effect on Europe. And I think this, well, this, we have Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry had an article, Russia's War on Ukraine is Reshaping Europe, in September 2023. So I guess it's just over a year old now. And he talked about how we've been prophesying for about 80 years that you would have a new European superpower within the Holy Roman Empire. He said, this prophecy is directly related to Russia's war on Ukraine. The terror that is gripping so many Europeans because of Russia's brutal invasion is going to cause 10 leaders in Europe to unite their nations or groups of nations dramatically and in exact accordance with the Bible's prophecies about that European empire. I've written on several occasions, and we've talked on several occasions, I could add, about Ezekiel 38 and verse 2, which discusses the Prince of Rosh, in the New King James Version, and the havoc he will wreak in this modern era. The way this prophecy is now coming to pass is impacting Europeans far more than any other people in the world. And so one of the big things we've focused on this show for the last 2 weeks has been leaderless Europe, leaderless Germany. This is a real cause to fear, again, at a time where Europe and when Germany is leaderless. It's going to be more pressure on Europe to come together and find some kind of strongman, find their own Vladimir Putin that can stand up for them, and more urgency to just not sit it out and wait a while and wait for a long coalition negotiation, and maybe in a year we'll have some other ineffective coalition in place. Like, this will impact some real urgency of maybe we need to bend some constitutional laws or some democratic niceties and parachute ourselves in our own Vladimir Putin. That's the kind of fear ramping up. And that's just this week. Where do we go next week? Where do we go from here? I think that's one important part of it. Another important way that it ties in, or important part of the news this week, is we did see Olaf Scholz make the first phone call to Vladimir Putin from a Western leader for, I think, a year or maybe more. Like, there's been this concerted effort to cut off Vladimir Putin and ostracize him. And Ukraine's leader, Volodymyr Zelensky, he accused Scholz of appeasement for making that phone call. That was last Friday. It was kind of before a lot of this kicked off. And you do wonder whether he knew things were about to kick off and wanted to touch base with Vladimir Putin. And we've speculated for a long time that Germany and Russia have negotiated some kind of deal. And this explains why you get this Scholzing, as it's become known in Germany, where Scholz will make these big promises of aid to Ukraine that often never actually deliver, or when they arrive, turn out to be very underwhelming. That they had this deal, but that both these leaders anticipated the Ukraine war to be over in a matter of weeks. And now that it's dragged on, it's left Scholz in a very awkward position where he's kind of being pulled in two directions at once. So anyway, he broke with that. He made this phone call. It also seems like he's trying to bring the war in Ukraine to an end because he's got his elections. And the way that you deal with this war has split the German electorate, and especially the German left, where he's losing kind of both sides. There are people that are leaving him because they think he's too hard on Russia and that he shouldn't be siding with Ukraine at all. He's losing a lot of people because they're saying you're not doing enough to back Ukraine. If he could end that war before the election, that's kind of his only hope at victory. So I think that's also part of what his phone call was about. But you're seeing, I think that's deeply significant, that you see Germany talking with Russia the same week or right before we have all of these other events explode. And again, we've said for so long that they've probably done some kind of a deal. The two of them are talking. Watch for a German-Russian deal. Germany absolutely fears Russia. But then part of that fear, yes, it drives them to have a strong leader. It also drives them to reach some kind of accommodation with Russia. And that will allow Germany to expand in other directions. And that ultimately, Germany overtly kind of leaving the Western alliance and siding with Russia, that's a massive moment for global geopolitics. And that's something else to watch for from all of this.
Yes, I just wanted to mention that whatever may happen with, undersea cables and Ukraine having permission to strike targets inside of Russia and any of the war's other immediate developments, whatever may happen with those, we should expect Vladimir Putin to survive all of this and actually to emerge from it even stronger. And that's because of what Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry has said about his role in this future Asian alliance. Several Bible passages talk about a massive end-time alliance of Asian nations. It's discussed in the books of Daniel and Joel and Revelation and some others. And then there's one especially detailed sort of a section about this in Ezekiel 38 and 39, which you mentioned a moment ago, but it really shows that this Prince of Russia figure who you mentioned will be at the head of this. And this is a still future war and series of wars that's still in the future. And so Mr. Fleury has said since late 2013 that this is all about Vladimir Putin, that Putin is the man who will be leading this Asian army, this huge Asian army in these still future wars. He explains all of that in detail in his booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Russia. And that booklet shows that Putin's biggest battles lie still ahead, still in the future for him. So however it all happens in the near term, we should expect him to survive the current war and to go on to lead this stunningly huge Asian alliance.
Thank you for that, Jeremiah. And one more article I'll mention, and maybe if you want a fairly short one-stop shop to get a picture of what is going on this week, I'll push this one. That is an article from Trump Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury from the spring of 2023 called The Ukraine War Will Not Start World War III. There has been a lot of talk of World War III this week, especially, you know, there have been people in the States saying, well, now that these weapons have been fired, the nuclear doctrine's been updated, he's going to strike back in a nuclear fashion. We've seen the ICBM strike. It does look pretty frightening the way that these things are ratcheting up. But this article goes in and explains exactly why. I mean, if I could whet your appetite, it does hit on so much of what we've talked about. I also think it's perhaps one of the most balanced pieces on Ukraine and Russia that I've read anywhere. I think it can be very easy in any conflict to kind of get drawn into cheerleading. Like, we do tend to human nature, we pick a side and we will exaggerate the rights of one side and minimize the rights on the other, or, you know, and we get very invested in that very easily. And I think this is a very, very balanced take. I mean, some of the headlines are Putin is right as the first subhead in terms of some of what NATO's been doing encroaching east, a German-Russian deal where he gets into what we've talked about, then the Budapest Memorandum that talks about the way that America has actually betrayed Ukraine and we promised to defend them and didn't. A change of direction, a cursed nation is another subhead. Then the Prince of Rosh getting into what is prophesied with Vladimir Putin. Trump's error. There's a subhead there that talks about something Donald Trump got very wrong in his first half. And then how World War III will start. Bible prophecy does talk about there being nuclear war coming, but it doesn't start this way. And it doesn't come from what is happening in Ukraine. God is very specific about how these events happen. They're not just random. And he's allowing them in a specific way, in a way that's going to bring the most people to repentance. And ultimately, that's what all of this is about. It's about showing that God rules in the kingdom of men, and it's not just random chaos. And so this, what's going on in Ukraine, it does play a critical role. It is a critical stepping point in the world to World War III, especially in the way that Europe is responding and the way that it's going to cause them to unite around a strong leader. But we're not going to see nuclear bombs going off in European and American cities, or Russian cities for that matter, in the next week or two. Like, this is not the start of World War III that you're seeing. And God is going to allow a warning message to go out for a bit longer and give people more opportunity to repent. And that opportunity will be there as all of this rolls out. So that's a great place to go to understand this conflict. Quick update on some other European stories. The German Chancellor Olaf Scholz is fighting for his survival, not just as Chancellor, but as leader of the Social Democrats. There's been a big push over the last week to replace him with his Defense Minister, Boris Pistorius, who is a lot more popular and could have a shot potentially at being Chancellor after the next elections. That's probably the latest update on the drama as Germany prepares to vote now at the end of February. France is going through its own electoral chaos. Remember, they've had a divided government, basically one third far left, one third center right-ish, one third kind of far right-ish. And they've been trying to get a budget through. Marine Le Pen is not happy. Nobody's really happy with where this budget is going. But she said this week that her party could push for a censure motion. If that passes, that would force the government to resign. That would put France again in a tricky position. So, and they're kind of stuck leaderless in the same way that Germany is. And then some economic data out of Europe. Inflation stats are still pretty high. We got the latest data there here in the UK. Inflation is now well above target. For Europe, it hit right about its 2% target, but it's only hitting that because sky-high energy prices have come down over the last 12 months. So inflation is still running hot. Once that kind of energy adjustment has gone through the system, they'll go back to being well above target. So that's going to probably keep interest rates high. That's going to keep affecting Europe's economy. And it means more economic pain for Europe. And that's something else that is going to push for major changes in Europe and a change of European leadership like we talked about earlier. But high inflation, that's a concern across all kinds of major economies. And that's one subject under discussion as the G20 met in Latin America this week. Here to tell us more about that meeting, we'll go to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, this is actually a really big conference here in the Western Hemisphere. About once a year, you have all the, or most of the world leaders in the Western Hemisphere meet together and talk about economic issues. This is a region that's really strategic to America's well-being. Our founding fathers actually, or James Monroe in particular, even dedicated a Monroe Doctrine to keeping Eastern Hemisphere powers out of the Western here, well, out of the Western Hemisphere, because they knew that any foreign involvement anywhere in Mexico, Central America, South America could end up being an existential threat to the United States. And with that in mind, this year's conference didn't actually go so well. Like last year, Mexico didn't even show up because the United States didn't invite Cuba, Honduras, or Venezuela because of their human rights violations and their basically communist form of government. So Mexico has basically said, it was like, if all those authoritarian communist regimes aren't invited to this, we're not coming either. Siding with them, Biden did not project a very strong image of confidence. The video footage shows him like at this podium with the jungle behind him. He spoke, and then as he often does, just kind of wandered away. Instead of like going down the trail, just kind of wandered away into the Amazon. I think we've seen him since then, so he's not lost in the jungle, although many people made that joke that he really didn't seem to know where in the world he was or where he was going.
Well, would that make him the second president to go off and explore the Amazon rainforest after his time in issue after Theodore Roosevelt?
Yeah, that's actually a good point. You're the first president since Theodore Roosevelt who decided to wander into the interior of the Amazon on his way out of office. But then also on a more serious note, a lot of the Latin American leaders who did show up were pretty critical, not just of Biden's performance, but just of like America's interest in the region, period. I think we've talked on this program before that China's actually building a deep water port in Peru. It'll actually be the first a deep water port in the Pacific coast of Latin America. Right now, if China wants to trade with Chile or Peru or Mexico or any of these countries, they actually have to ship the goods on smaller boats north to California. And then once it gets to California, you can put it on a transoceanic tanker head to China. By building this deep water port in Peru, it's basically allowing China to cut the United States out of the trade chain. You don't actually have to send lithium from Chile to California to get it to China. You can send the lithium to Peru and send it to China directly. No stops in the United States. The Peruvians are pretty excited about this. Actually, the former Peruvian finance minister, Alex Contreras, he was defending his decision. He says, if you have to choose between no investment and Chinese investment, take the Chinese investment. So making the point that I think he was getting some criticism is like, well, why is Peru so pro-China? and so pro, so anti-America. And he's like, well, he's like, America's not giving any investment opportunities to Peru. So we're going to the country that is investing in our infrastructure, in our ports, in our mining facilities, which then gives China the ability that, like, if this ever comes down to lithium's one of those minerals that Chile makes a lot of, it's a necessary ingredient for a lot of high-tech electronics used in the defense industry. If you ever get in like a resource war competition between China and the United States over lithium, China's very well positioned to win that resource war because you're not getting American involvement in this infrastructure. And I think that might be something the Trump administration could look at changing. Trump's notoriously, he's not very pro-free trade. He wants to put a tariff on most of these Latin American countries to protect American industry, which isn't winning him a lot of friends down there. Although a lot of his advisors associated with the Heritage Foundation are at least pushing him to consider more investment in Pacific nations. The report I read was specifically about Fiji and some of these island nations in the South Pacific, but basically saying that, like, if we could get American investment in some of the infrastructure in these countries, whether we put a tariff on their imports or not, it would actually help the geopolitical relationship with these countries. So we don't really get outplayed by China, where we need the lithium in Chile because that's where it is. But all the ports and all the infrastructure and all the railroads are Chinese made.
So this is something that has a lot of long range consequences for the United States. I mean, that point that you made about Peru no longer needs to ship things via Los Angeles is really interesting. I hadn't seen that brought up in these discussions. And it is a really powerful picture then with these deals, with everybody meeting, of the way that China is moving into Latin America. I know Europe as well is every year, at the end of the year, there's always this big push to get Mercosur, their trade deal signed with Mercosur, where they would love to have a Latin American trade deal set up. So they're working. They would love to move in and do more deals with Latin America as well. Meanwhile, America, at least under the Biden administration, hasn't seemed particularly interested. And just like the Ukraine we talked about, Bible prophecy is very specific. Ukraine crisis isn't going to lead to World War III, but the Bible tells us, or it's not going to spark World War III. It is a stepping stone. But the Bible also specifically brings in trade and America being cut off from trade networks in a way that we even start to see happening in Latin America.
Right. We actually have an article our editor-in-chief wrote a few years ago now, actually more than 4 years ago now. It was during President Trump's first term, titled America is Being Economically Besieged, which was specifically about the European Union's attempts to make a trade deal with Latin America, the Mercosur Alliance. That article, it definitely has a strong sense of urgency. I think the first paragraph, it was even predicting that there was going to be an EU trade deal between Mercosur the year it was written. Now, there have been some complications with that trade deal. It's still in the works. It's not actually in place yet. But it does highlight the strategic threat of like a Europe Latin America team up against the United States. The threat would be equally bad if it's a China Latin America team up against the United States, and even worse if it's a China Latin America Europe team up against the United States. But it specifically talks about a prophecy in the Blessings and Cursings chapter of the Bible, Deuteronomy 28, that talks about like the punishment for America if it breaks God's law is that you will be besieged in all your gates. And the gates, these are like the sea gates, like the Panama Canal being one of the most important ones there, where you've actually got China, Europe working together to besiege America out of world trade. And the resource war is particularly dangerous there. I know Donald Trump's trying to make the case that, like, well, if we can get some tariffs and make America, bring some industry back to America and make America so self-sufficient, we won't be reliant on some of these goods like clothes and stuff like that manufactured in foreign countries. But when it comes to like the copper and the lithium and the rare earth minerals, those are things where you have to mine them where they are. And so that actually, yeah, the lithium example just came to mind because Chile's so strategic for lithium. So, and then China recognizes that. And I mean, that's why they're building these ports and they're building these railroads. Europe also recognizes that and are trying to get some trade deals in with this Mercosur alliance. And America so far has not done much to enforce the Monroe Doctrine and keep these Eastern Hemisphere powers out of Latin America, or even to get some of the investment in some railroads and stuff down there that really could help U.S. companies. I mean, Donald Trump's made it a goal to revive America's manufacturing sector. It was like, well, the manufacturing industries do need some of those minerals in South America and other places. And so there's kind of been a blind spot in U.S. policy that could make it easier for these power blocks like Russia and China to move into these regions and besiege the United States, which the Bible explicitly does say will happen if America doesn't keep God's laws and statutes.
Great. Well, thank you for that, Andrew. And some of the other news that we've had coming out of the United States, and it also involves Latin America, but more from the case of Latin American migrants in the United States and how they're dealt with.
Yeah, well, Trump's made a big point, the deal that some of these free trade agreements like NAFTA have actually kind of hurt Mexico's agriculture sector and even helped spur a lot of Mexicans to want to come to the United States. So the migrant crisis has been a strategic threat to America for a long time. Donald Trump's gearing up to do some big deportations if he can get the support, though it might not be as easy as he thinks, because some of these Democratic-controlled cities, Los Angeles particular this week, voted to declare themselves a sanctuary city, saying that any illegal immigrants that can make it to Los Angeles, the local city officials will protect them from deportation. Which is really a big curse on America to actually have illegals be able like flout our laws like this, and then even have city officials support these people who've committed a crime against the U.S. government. Another big curse on America is they had a once-in-a-decade bomb cyclone thrash the western coast of North America this week, just showing that in addition to the trade curses we're suffering and the immigration curses we're suffering, we're also increased natural disasters. And then one incident that actually could be some good news in the short run is Franklin Graham and some other fairly prominent evangelical Christian leaders in the United States have vocally supported this week Donald Trump's decision to abolish the U.S. Department of Education. That's a department whose main function right now seems to be overruling state officials trying to remove pornographic and homosexual books from elementary school libraries. So the department's definitely not doing anything for the moral fiber of the United States. Donald Trump would like to save the $238 billion by just getting rid of it. And it looks like a number of the religious leaders in America think that sounds like a really good idea.
Well, thank you very much for that, Andrew. We'll take a quick break now. When we get back, we'll talk about the International Criminal Court ruling against Netanyahu. We got a little bit fed up earlier, Mihailo and I, with our stories being overtaken by events. So we actually did that one as a live segment on Thursday afternoon. So we'll play that back for you as part of this Week in Review show next. Israel has issued an arrest warrant for Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister. It's one of several big, fast-moving stories this week. So we've decided to do something a little bit different for our Trumpet World Week in Review show. We're going to cover this week's Middle East news now, live with my colleague Mihailo Zekic, who focuses on watching the Middle East. We'll get to the rest later, perhaps with another live show tomorrow. And then we'll stitch that together, and that will be our cutting-edge Week in Review program. That way we can give you up-to-the-minute news with these fast-paced events. So without further ado, we can cue the stinger and get going on this week's Trumpet World. What a week it has been. The first use of an intercontinental ballistic missile in war. We were getting ready to go with that as our main story for the Trumpet World Week in Review. Then we also had some other massive news with the International Criminal Court issuing a arrest warrant for the Israeli Prime Minister, the former defense minister, and I think also Hamas's probably now deceased military chief. Here to keep us all up to date on that, I'm joined by Mihailo Zekic.
Yes, thank you for being here. Thank you for having me.
So, yeah, can you catch us up on that news?
Yeah, so today, as you mentioned, the International Criminal Court announced arrest warrants for Benjamin Netanyahu, as well as Yoav Gallant, who, as we've talked about, I think a couple of weeks ago, until recently, was Israel's defense minister. Mohammed Dayef, the Hamas leader that you mentioned, Israel claimed to have killed him in July. The ICC says they haven't seen any evidence of that. They were also supposed to give warrants for Yahya Sinwar and Ismail Haniyeh, Hamas's two other big fish that, of course, Israel had killed by now. But the emphasis, of course, for obvious reasons, is on the democratically elected prime minister of Israel and his defense minister, whom to this point most people saw as a moderating force in the war on Gaza. The two specific charges that the ICC are launching at those two are war crimes and crimes against humanity, mainly centered around their claim that those two men in leading the war effort have purposely, with malignant intent, and systematically tried to stop aid, like food and other vital supplies, from getting into Gaza.
Using starvation as a weapon of warfare, I think, is one of the terms.
Yes, exactly. In other words, basically enacting their own Holodomor in Gaza. First off, Israel's war effort is extremely well documented, and I mean the fact that you hear stories about like how much, like thousands and thousands of trucks entering in Israel or into Gaza to distribute aid. Like, Israel is not putting up a blockade on Gaza in a war zone, which you'd expect it to. Like, if it was, Ukraine's not trading with Russia right now. Like, North Korea and South Korea aren't trading, but Israel, because it's Israel, gets singled out for doing something that it's very demonstrably not doing.
Yeah, I think that, like, there's two, to me, looking at these accusations, you can get into the details and you can show how each detail is demonstrably false. And then you can look at the overall picture and also see that the overall picture that they're presenting is demonstrably false. So, you know, like, you know, you mentioned the use of starvation and the, I think I've got the exact wording here, where they accused Israel imposed a total siege over Gaza that involved completely closing the three border crossing points, Rafah, Kerem Shalom, and Eretz. I mean, that's a total lie. Like, these, okay, we can get into the minutiae, and that's not true. Egypt has controlled the Rafah crossing, not Israel. For the rest, Israel has actually had them open for most of the time that the International Criminal Court was writing, not closed. They, in fact, extended and, you know, Hamas damaged one of the border crossings. They repaired it and extended it so they could get more supplies through. I think it was when the court made this statement, I've got it here, that they had 20,000 trucks carrying 400,000 tons of food had been traveled into Gaza through these crossings. So the court says Israel has imposed a policy of starvation, and the reality is that Israel has let in 400,000 tons of food. That is it's a total lie. And okay, they made these accusations back in the spring. All of these lies have all been pointed out, yet we've still come to this point where these judges have approved the arrest warrant?
It gets better. They're putting the term of from what date to what date when they're expecting these crimes to have been committed to October 8th last year. One day after the October 7th massacre, weeks before Israel even started their ground invasion. So in other words, the time for looking at when Israel is committing war crimes is literally the day after the invasion that they suffered started, before they even had a chance to respond to it. And Israel, for its part, it was it sent a few disputes, I don't know if that's the right word, but objections, there we go. It sent a few objections to the court on them going through with this, one of them being that Israel is not a party to the Rome Statute, which gives the court its legitimacy. And they said, but the state of Palestine is, even though a lot of the world doesn't recognize the state of Palestine, even though Gaza itself is not under jurisdiction of the Palestinian Authority currently, which is supposedly the state of Palestine. And Israel also mentioned that they didn't receive advanced news from the court about what was going on, that they needed time to prepare their own defense, etc. And this is, I quote now from the press release that the court released today about their argument against this. Quote, the chamber also rejected Israel's request under Article 18.1 of the statute. The chamber recalled that the prosecution notified Israel of the initiation of an investigation in 2021.
Oh, before Gaza.
Yes! I mean, I'll have to look into a little bit more about what exactly that meant, but I mean, what do you mean 2021? That was before Netanyahu. I don't even think Netanyahu was in power at that, or he was just about to come into power. Gallant certainly wasn't in power then.
Yeah, that is, I mean, when you started that, I was like, okay, I'm not really interested in the legal minutia, obviously, about who has jurisdiction, and I don't know, like, I'm more interested in moral right and wrong and people lying and but the idea that 2021, like that it's, they apparently notified Israel of this case before the Gaza war that this is all about started, that is pretty shocking. At best, that seems like a typo, but you'd have thought of something in this magnitude, they would have had a chance to iron out all of these typos or anything like that. But I think going back to, you know, things being wrong in the details and then wrong in the overall picture, like this overall picture that Israel is committing genocide, I think is just also so provably and demonstrably false. Like, again, you can look at the statistics. You know, it's like people say so often, numbers don't care about your feelings. Facts don't care about your feelings. Yes, you may be angry with Israel. That doesn't change the facts. And the facts are no other modern military has worked harder to avoid civilian casualties than Israel. No other country has achieved such a low civilian casualty rate for high-intensity urban warfare than Israel has. I mean, I think it was back in May when you first had these, they were pursuing an arrest warrant, and you took Hamas's own figures, and Israel was killing one civilian for every combatant. That is way lower than the casualty rate. Like, America was killing far more civilians per combatant when they were involved in Afghanistan and in Iraq when they were involved in the higher intensity fighting. Now, you'll see some statistics that then expand that out to more of the peacekeeping operation. And at that point, yeah, civilian casualties were lower because you don't have this high intensity warfare. So, yeah, this idea of genocide itself, the idea that Israel is committing genocide is, again, provably and demonstrably false. And yet this International Criminal Court, one of the most prestigious and highly regarded courts in the world, has gone ahead and made this accusation.
Indeed. And it puts Mr. Netanyahu in some ignoble company. Genocide is obviously, it's a very serious term. It's not like this court or any other international institution throws it around willy-nilly. Here's a couple of people that they have charged with it. Omar Bashir, you might recognize that name, the former dictator of Sudan that caused the Darfur crisis. And last year, Vladimir Putin, for his government's admitting to kidnapping thousands of Ukrainian children to send back to Russia.
But then they've not gone after Bashar al-Assad. They've not gone after Khomeini. There are plenty of dictators that they haven't gone after.
Exactly. And if you look at the countries that are party to the statute, you notice that Iran's not a party, China's not a party, Turkey, Cuba, all these countries that normally these kinds of institutions are made to go after in the first place, they're not a member of it. But even though these countries, many of them have attacked member countries that are a party to this statute, we still don't see these kinds of charges being leveled up against them. But do you know who is a member? Even when the Taliban came in Afghanistan, to this point, since 2021, I think it was just about a month ago when somebody brought up a complaint to the ICC that the Taliban were doing illegal things under their view, even though they came to power again in 2021. And there's a lot of other countries in sub-Saharan Africa, for example, like Mali. We've heard a lot recently about the coup there and some of the repercussions going on there. There's a lot of places that you'd think the ICC would have more of an interest in actually going to help people.
And I think that's the tragedy of this story is it hurts the ICC. This is going to hurt the ICC more than it hurts Israel. Because, and it's certainly, there's already, I think the next Senate majority leader is tweeting out how outrageous this is. You know, rightly so, he's upset about this. And they're looking at America putting sanctions on the ICC. And this is what Israel's president, Isaac Herzog, said, tweeted, taken in bad faith, the outrageous decision at the ICC has turned a universal justice into a laughingstock. It makes a mockery of the sacrifice of all of those who fight for justice, from Allied victory over the Nazis till today. And he's right. And, like, part of the reason why I'm upset about this is I do think the ICC is important and has a very important role to play in international relations and in the international community. We're going to have to keep this fairly tight because I have my international relations class to teach in 13 minutes. They do play a very important role. And Herbert W. Armstrong, the ICC is a bit more of a recent invention, but he was really honored by the International Court of Justice. Many of their judges, there was a state dinner in his honor. He gave speeches there. He talked about the importance of using the role that international law plays in the pursuit of world peace, and that if we're ever going to have world peace, it's got to have a basis in international law. And maybe I'll be able to read you a few quotes from that in a minute. So, you know, this damages this push. I mean, this kind of idea of we're going to have courts that are going to uphold international law came about after World War II, and it came about to prevent Nazi atrocities from ever happening again. Now, if you were to apply the logic that the ICC used in this case, Winston Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt would be now being pursued for arrest warrants under the ICC. Now, probably this ICC wouldn't do that because Winston Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt aren't Jewish. And I think it's quite clear they're applying one standard to Jewish leaders and another to everybody else. But that shows how damaged this court has become. Like, this thing that we need for international relations that is meant to be doing a good thing of upholding international law has decided to throw law and facts and truth out the window to instead go after their own vendettas and biases.
Indeed. Now, moving forward, like, it's one thing to say, okay, some judge that doesn't even represent their own country's government signs a piece of paper. What does that mean? Well, going forward, this means that the 125 state parties of the Rome Statute now have an obligation to arrest Netanyahu and arrest Gallant if they ever travel to those countries. Again, as I mentioned, that leaves out quite a few shall we say, perennial perpetrators of some of these international laws. It also doesn't include the United States, Netanyahu's most important ally. So he does have a bit of silver lining there. But if you ever want to travel anywhere in the European Union, almost every country in Latin America, the United Kingdom, Canada, Australia, Japan, South Korea, South Africa, Jordan, its neighbor, they all have an obligation to extradite Netanyahu and Gallant to The Hague.
And I think, again, this is where it probably hurts the ICC more than it hurts Netanyahu. He can still travel to the United States. It would not surprise me if we start to see more and more countries just ignoring the ICC, the way that they have with Vladimir Putin. Yeah, not doing what it says.
Mm-hmm. And even there is a bit of silver lining in Israeli domestic politics.
Are they all rallied around him?
Yeah, obviously his coalition is rallying around. So the president, Isaac Herzog, he belongs to the Labour Party. He's slamming the ICC. Benny Gantz, the main opposition figure in the Knesset against Netanyahu. He's also slammed this. Gallant, for his part, we've talked before a couple of weeks ago about how his firing was pretty controversial in Israel, but now that his name's still on the ticket, that's probably going to be all smoothed away. And again, when you're indicting the prime minister and the defense minister, you're, by extension, maybe not on the piece of paper, but you're blaming the entire army and, by extent, the entire war effort, which includes the civilian society in this case.
I think is the bigger, is where there is a big genuine danger to Israel, is if then this starts to become pursuing individual members of the IDF through the courts.
That's true. ICC hasn't really done that so much except for low-hanging fruit, like, say, people captured from Syria and sent over, or like African countries that have been overthrown. But in regards to the Israeli populace themselves, we were starting to see coming up to now a lot of those old tensions, like the anti-Netanyahu, we need to get rid of Bibi at all costs, bubbling up. I think this is going to smooth things over for a bit, and this is going to help him out, at least domestically.
But certainly internationally, that's a good point as well in the domestic scene. But internationally, earlier today we pre-recorded our Trumpet World Week in Review segment for the Middle East to go out tomorrow. Just with the scheduling, we often record on Wednesday. It gives George more time to do editing and post-production. And we were talking, when the ICC thing came out, it's like, great, okay, we've got to re-record. We've got to do more on the big news. And it was like, well, how do we fit this in with our schedules? Well, actually doing a live show so that we can get the latest commentary on this seems the way to go. But this morning we were talking about the Pope's comments. And I think you made an interesting, really interesting point in some of our discussions after then. Do you want to just summarize a little briefly what we talked about this morning with the Pope's comments from his book over the weekend and how this may tie into this story?
Of course. Well, on November 19th, Pope Francis's autobiography, well, I guess it's more of a him being interviewed by a journalist and these interviews being mashed together in a compilation. It was released in Italian and Spanish, and obviously the Pope is a very important international figure. He obviously has a lot in his mind.
That's not the most insightful thing you've ever said on this show, by the way.
Well, is the Pope Catholic?
Yeah, good question. Sorry, go on.
Well, anyway, he's obviously has a lot more in his mind than just, say, feeding the poor or like the typical topics that most leaders of churches talk about. And in this case, he brought up the wars in the Middle East. There was a relevant excerpt that was leaked to the Italian publication La Stampa. And this is what it says, quote, "According to some experts, what is happening in Gaza has the characteristics of a genocide. It should be carefully investigated to determine whether it fits into the technical definition formulated by jurists and international bodies," end quote. The Pope said a lot of negative things about Israel in the past. This is probably the most blatant and accusatory of them. What international bodies is he talking about? There's only two main ones, at least, that are looking at Netanyahu and Israel, the ICC and the World Court affiliate with the UN, which is tiptoeing a bit more, but we have to cover this because there's a lot of countries on our back, but we don't want to make everyone else mad either. I don't want to put words into his mouth, but you look up until this time, there's been very much silence among most world leaders, including Joe Biden, who's had a lot of things to say about Netanyahu, about the ICC, and more criticism than anything from most world leaders. Pope Francis is probably the first biggie, at least in the Western world, to say anything about this. You mentioned Vladimir Putin before. The judges took 23 days to decide that he was guilty of everything that was going on. They took 6 months for Israel. People were wondering, why is it taking so long? The Pope comes, says this, and then a few days later, you get this ruling from an international body that's based in his home turf of Europe, of course. Whether this has anything to do with it, it's too early to say, but I think that at very least it is a very, very intriguing coincidence.
And like we talked about we made the point, or you might have done, that he hasn't talked this way about the Ukrainian war. There are a lot of Ukrainian Catholics actually very frustrated that he won't speak out about allegations of Russian genocide in Ukraine. I think there's one pretty oblique statement that he has made about China and their genocide and what's happening with the Uyghurs.
You haven't even heard this much about Hezbollah that Israel's also fighting, even though they have a way bigger Catholic population.
Right. So there's something, you know, the Pope is focused on Israel in an unusual way. I think you also mentioned something I didn't realize on this morning, where you talked about how he's talking to
the main Catholic leader of the one congregation that they have in Gaza. Has roughly 600 people every day at 7 p.m. his time.
So, I mean, you think about how hard it is for a world leader to get an audience with the Pope. He's talking to that guy every day. So he knows the facts, yet he misrepresents them. He makes these baseless accusations of genocide in this quote. And what we talked about in that show is that the Catholic Church has its own agenda in the Middle East. And we have our article, As You Watch Germany Watch Gaza, which I am just trying to... here we go, get on the... there we go. You can stick that up now, George. As You Watch Gaza Watch Germany, where Mr. Flurry goes through a lot of the analysis that we talked about this morning, that the Catholic Church has its own interests, its own agenda with what is happening in the Middle East, that even before October 7th, they were calling for some kind of international governance over Jerusalem. They have an unusual focus there. And that article goes on, and we might just even post perhaps as just a shorter video clip what we talked about in this morning, rather than just throwing it in the dustbin because it's kind of out of date. But we went... we talked about the way that you've got this power rising in Europe. Israel thinks that it can trust it, that it can look to it. I mean, you've got an article in the upcoming Trumpet Print about even the role that potentially Europe and some of its Middle Eastern allies could play in the post-Gaza reconstruction. So Israel trusts Europe, but you look at what the Pope, who speaks for all these Catholics, is saying, and has been saying for the last 10 years. I mean, on that show, you went back to some things from 2014 and his trip to Jerusalem. There are some deeply, deeply worrying things going on there. So Europe, there's a lot of growing animosity to Israel all around the world that they really need to be aware of. That's going to make their life harder. I just wanted to touch on, again, Mr. Armstrong and his interactions with the international court system, where... He attended the first United Nations summit in 1945, where he said there can be no real peace until we have justice for all. And he talked about, well, there's laws that cause peace. And if there's injustice, someone is breaking the law. Until that is rectified, there can't be peace. But, that statement, there can be no real peace until we have justice for all. The International Criminal Court's statements are a concern for all. This is dangerous for all. And he talked about an International Court of Justice that was visiting his college. He said, he and I are in agreement in principle on what it will take to bring world peace. In his lectures, he said two ingredients are basic, law and authority. Law without authority would be flouted and produce anarchy. Authority without law would be despotism and tyranny. Yet now, this is a court that is... ultimately protecting Hamas, making it easier for the bad guys, easier for the people that are really violating all law and justice. And this is the organizations, the United Nations. We had some more news this morning from the United Nations where UNRWA, there was photos of UNRWA, I think, getting together with Hamas, and I think it was 2017, and they're meeting with and coordinating things with Hamas. Like all of these organizations, United Nations, International Criminal Court, that are designed to bring about world peace are failing horribly. And that's not just a problem if you're a Jew. That is a problem for everyone. This is, it ties right in with that first use of the international or the intercontinental ballistic missile that we saw last night as well. Like this is what is there to bring world peace and to solve the problem of nuclear war. And instead, they are causes now of much more and much greater injustice.
Indeed. I think it's, the ICC is obviously not affiliated with the UN, but I think it's interesting that you mentioned these institutions coming together to make sure what happened with Nazism doesn't happen again. And you fast forward 70 years, 80 years, and we've come full circle. Now the targets of the Nazis are being targeted themselves by these institutions, even though a year ago they experienced the same kind of atrocities. It's a point that you go to often in some of the material you produce, that Mr. Gerald Fleury, our editor-in-chief, goes to often when looking at situations like this, is that there is no help in man. that no matter man's best efforts, no matter even if it has the most surest footing, 125 countries coming together agreeing we need one standard for all of us and we're going to uphold the law, and this is the end result. No matter what, and I mean, every time there's a global crisis, it seems like we have this discussion again. After Napoleon was defeated, after World War I, everyone says, okay, we're serious this time. We're going to come together and create peace. And the next even bigger world crisis is the result.
Yeah, we've had this long track record of failure, and that is one of the big lessons. There's no help in God. And I'm sorry, no help in man. Thank you. Yes, want to get that straight. We also concluded this morning, we were talking about that there is, God's prophecies is very, very specific. And we'll talk with Jeremiah more about the intercontinental ballistic missile. But we've been saying all week, what's happening in Ukraine is not going to lead to World War III. Like, God says that there's going to be no help in man, but he spells out the end and he spells out all of the details and how it's going to happen to show us that there is hope in God and that all of this is happening according to his plan. And I think we'll get into some of the other details of that on this kind of second part of our show when we get into that later. Before we conclude this Middle East bit, though, were there any other Middle Eastern stories you wanted to give us a very quick rundown of?
Yes, well, for obvious reasons, as I'm preparing for this, I don't have the latest update on this, but the United States, Great Britain, France, and Germany have decided to censure Iran at the International Atomic Energy Agency. That's like the one international institution I have some support with because they do try to do a good job, but they're always hamstrung in the fact that no one gives them any authority to carry out their mandate. But anyway, Iran obviously has been flouting a lot of the provisions trying to stop it from getting a nuclear bomb. Once the censure goes through, it could trigger a vote, which, if that passes with the IAEA's members, it means we could get a more comprehensive investigation into the open questions Iran isn't answering, as well as potentially even some of those sanctions that were lifted against Iran on the international sphere when the JCPOA in 2016 came into effect. So the vote could happen. Some people are speculating today. We'll wait and see what happens with that. And also, Spiegel earlier this week published an article claiming that the Association of German Ship Owners had been for months receiving threatening emails from the Houthis, the rebel group in Yemen, that need to leave, not even just not sail through the Red Sea, but don't dock at any Israel port or else your ships are fair game. And of course, the Ship Owners Association sent all the information to the German Navy, as you would expect. And I'm sure the Houthis knew that too. We're seeing Germany get more and more involved in the Middle East. Last month, I believe, earlier this month, a German frigate shot down a drone that was flying in from Lebanon by Hezbollah to Israel. And I think the Houthis are trying to do a bit of saber rattling as preventative measures to stop Germany from maybe taking more an interest in Yemen as well. But either way, we're seeing Germany get more and more interested in the Middle East, as we just talked about, and we're going to see Germany start to become a more important player in this as well.
That is an important story to keep an eye on. And when we do the second part, we'll talk about how Europe is being transformed by this war with Ukraine. And I think the fact that it's happening while Germany is leaderless, you're getting this pressure from them in the Middle East, pressure from Russia, that is really going to pressure some change in Germany. Well, thank you so much for that, Mihailo. I'll just leave you, we've mentioned a few bits, a few articles. I'll just leave you with a quick plug for Herbert W. Armstrong's book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. We kind of ended by talking about, God rules in the kingdom of men. God has a plan in the midst of all of these chaotic and rather frightening world events. And that book is a great introduction to exactly what that plan is. And you can read that online. You can order your own free print copy at our website, thetrumpet.com. Thank you so much for joining us, especially to those that kind of hopped on live as we did this impromptu live session. Really appreciate your company. Keep watching your world.